Hello and welcome everyone to episode 429 of Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always are James Jones.
I'm the real Excite Truck.
John Lindemann.
Don't you mean fuck truck?
No, yeah. I don't, John. We get enough email. We get enough emails about me, John. We're good. Thank you.
I'm just starting to cuss right off the bat.
Great start to the show, by the way.
Turn your speakers down, folks.
Yeah, we also have Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
Thanks for spoiling my new business.
Yeah, really.
But nobody would have known, Guillaume, until you went into it.
Hmm. And also joining us for the very first time is Guillaume's girlfriend. Is that the right term?
That's right.
Okay, Guillaume's girlfriend.
If Ms. you must call Karen, it that.
Miss Karen Oberer.
Hi, I'm used to just being called the girlfriend on the podcast, so you can just call me the girlfriend.
That's not true.
That's true.
You know it is.
Sometimes he says Karen. So yes, everyone listening has heard Guillaume refer to Karen, and of course you play a lot of games with Guillaume, and that often informs his choices and also his perspectives on some of these games. So we're excited to have you here to talk about a game that you've both been playing recently. But up first, and by the way, we are going to get into listener mail later in the show, but we have a lot of new business here with five people, and we're going to kick it off actually with Guillaume.
Yeah, so I've been, last Christmas, I found a lot of good deals on old games, and one Wii game that I had skipped because I wasn't there for the Wii launch. I picked it up maybe 1 year later. It's Excite Truck. And, I had stayed away from that game for a long time because the game was $60 here in the Canada, maybe in the US too, I'm not sure.
Nope.
I think it was cheaper in the US.
It was 50.
It was 50, right. So it was 16 Canada and it stayed that way for a long time. And, meanwhile, like, I went back and played other crappier games, from the Wii launch, like, Rayman Raving Rabbids, which was not the best in the series. But that game hit $20 so fast. So I've played Excite Bots before I've played Excite Truck. And, it's a little bit hard to go back to. It's the first thing that you notice is that the game is a crime against music. It's got the worst kind of rock, butt rock music that I've ever heard. And
it's like what if F-Zero had a terrible soundtrack?
Yeah,
you know, it's like the similar kind of attitude, except no talent applied. Like, it's just really, it sounds so bad that you wonder if it's actually intentionally bad. Like, maybe this is actually like a really good music composer and he's like trying to make the most redneck, awful, grating rock music that he possibly could.
You know, this is my running mix. Thank you. So
really, no, I think, like, it's kind of like F-Zero X, but nothing catchy about it at all. So, I was pretty relieved to see that the whole, playing your MP3s instead of, the in-game music still works. I was worried that maybe because after a while, the Nintendo ditched MP3 support, in their photo app. I thought, what if, this game uses that, like this codec and just won't be able to read the MP3s anymore. But no, the function is still there. But to test it out, I grabbed the first MP3 that I could, and Racing to Amy Mann, Lost in Space, is just really weird and really, I don't know, I don't recommend it. It's a little bit too chill.
It's great for that course where it starts to rain frogs. That's my favorite road hazard in Excite Truck.
Yeah, so
Canada, does that happen
Seattle,
in Canada?
So sometimes. Yeah, it's a cool game, but it doesn't compare favorably to Excite Bots. Excite Bots, I mean, I just started that game, like it's as fast as Excite Truck, and it just cranks up the stupidity to 11. You know, in this game, you've got, in the Excite Truck, you go through rings, right? In Excite Bots, you go through sandwich parts. I mean, it's not even comparable.
But I mean, the sandwich gag just gets old really fast.
Yeah, I guess so. But I don't know. I never get tired of super sandwiches.
Excite Truck is already plenty ridiculous. And to me, Excite Bots, although a better game in a lot of ways, I think it just plays better. But the style of Excite Bots makes no sense and
no.
doesn't add that much to it, I think.
Well, I think it does add something, because Excitetruck, it's kind of weird to say this, but it kind of lacks personality a bit. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got these locales that are supposed to be based on real countries, at least. You know, you've got a Canada and a Fiji Island and a, I don't know, you've got a few others, a Scotland, and Karen, who's a big fan of Scotland, has been there many times, says that, yes, it kind of looks like Scotland, but I don't know, there's not really...
It's definitely on Earth.
Yeah, there's not that many distinctive features, you know, there's no monuments, there's no, you know, I'm used to...
Wait, in Scotland, aren't you, like, racing through an old castle?
Maybe I'm just not far into the game enough.
But... No, it's just a generic castle. It's not like, right. It's not something you would reckon. It's just
okay,
right? Yeah. Like
I would put it on the level of Beetle Adventure Racing in terms of wackiness.
A 20-year-old game.
Screw you.
For instance, the Canada course, I would expect to go next to, you know, the CN Tower and you know, other famous landmarks, Club SpaceX or, you know, something. But in this case, it's just like it's trees and forests. And while we had a lot of that, you know, we've got other stuff. We've got tar sands and we've got, you know, we've got other things to show.
Glaciers.
Ontario Place.
Tar sand adventure racing.
Yep.
I think the reference of Club SuperSex kind of went over the heads of, or will go over the heads of your listeners. I don't think people know Club SuperSex outside of Montreal.
As did my Magnolia joke earlier.
I was going to say it, but I just thought the audience was too small, you know what I mean? I didn't think anybody would appreciate it. I know you guys would, but...
Guillaume, are you finding, you know, to me the best part of Excitetruck was always the scoring system where you're driving crazy and you're picking up all these stars and there's lots of ways to win a race other than just getting first place. And to me, that was really what made it so addictive. Are you finding that system holds up?
Yes and no. It does because, yes, you don't have to finish first to win the race. And that's great. You can do, tricks, like you can do spins while you're in the air. When you drift, it gives you points. When you go through trees, it gives you points. The one problem I have is that everything controls a little bit less well than in Excitebots. So, you know, like the tricks I find are pretty unreliable. I'm trying to pull them off and you have to hold two buttons on the Wii remote and kind of like jerk it left and right. And it just doesn't seem to work all that well. And same thing with like the jumps. I think the physics are a little bit off, or I don't know, maybe I'm just not used to it. But every time that I hit a ramp, I always seem to go in various directions. Like there's almost no rhyme or reason, you know, like I'm going up a hill and all of a sudden I'm kind of, veering too far to the left or to the right. And, I don't know, maybe I just need to get good, but, I'm still enjoying the game. It's just, you know, after the, in my opinion, superior sequel, it's a little bit weird to go back to.
Hmm. Yeah, that's understandable.
Yeah, and the other thing that I've played, actually, it's a DS game from 2009, except that I haven't played the DS game. I've played the remake on PlayStation Network, Might and Magic Call of Heroes. I think that long ago, Johnny, you talked about this game back when it was on DS, but it's this kind of weird strategy / puzzle game hybrid. And it's not doing these things in a way that I had ever seen before. You know, like there's the market right now is almost flooded, especially on iOS, like flooded with puzzle games that are also quote unquote RPGs because you level up and things like that. But in this game, it's really, you do level up. There is that element, but you're, instead of matching gems or candy or whatever, you're matching units. And these units, if you match them vertically, they're going to attack your opponent. If you match them horizontally, they're going to transform into a barrier that's going to protect you. And just the way that you can try to kind of do combos with them, but in a weird way, like you'll have certain units take more time to prepare an attack. They might take like 3 turns. And so... You know, you set them up and then the enemy has its turn and then it's your turn again. And then you might try to, combine some of your units that take only two turns to prep. And in that way, the units that you set up earlier and the units that you're setting up now, they're going to attack at the same time and you're going to get bonuses. So yeah, like it's a weird kind of strategy, puzzle hybrid. And I'm really enjoying that aspect of it. The problem that I have is that the PSN version is super sluggish and the game has a lot of, you know, story that I don't really care too much about. And I'm trying to skip it, but, you have to move your character on a map and there's a lot of areas that you can visit, but every time that you enter a cave, every time that you visit a new area, every time that a battle starts, there's a 30 seconds load time. And that just kind of killed the game for me. Like I tried it one evening and I played it for maybe 2 hours. And then I thought, do I want to keep doing this? Do I want to keep waiting at load times for like the next 20 hours? And I decided that, yeah, maybe it was too late. Like maybe when the game was new, I would have had enough excitement about it to actually play through it. But in this case, like I'm literally just playing something that I picked up on sale years ago that I never touched. And I'm like, okay, maybe I should actually give this a spin. And I'm, you know, the motivation is not really there. I can recognize that it's a good game, but I'm feeling like if I had played it on the DS back when it came out, I would have really gotten into it. But at this point,
it actually got good reviews on the DS, did it not? Because I remember this.
It absolutely did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, when it came out on 360 and PS3, and I think you can get it on PC, it's got a crazy title, and I don't think it's like any other Might and Magic game.
No.
But it's really fun. I think, Guillaume, I don't know how far you got into it, and I couldn't really describe how far I got into it, but I was definitely at the point where you were starting to get three or four different options in terms of the magic animals that you can gather on the field. I don't know if you saw that. There were stags and bears and stuff like that. And once you get that far into the game, the strategy gets way more interesting, I would say, and it really starts to shine, but it also gets more difficult and the battles end up feeling like they kind of take longer because they're kind of piling mechanics on top of what you see early in the game, which is already fairly complex. So I burned out on it a bit just because it felt like everything was taking way too long to suss out and I would die a bunch. But I did find it actually really interesting and cool and you know, just something that it was going to take too much time investment for me to really figure it out and keep going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of what I thought of it when I played it. And I don't know. I feel like this is the kind of game that I would have expected to keep being ported, but maybe it was too big of a failure to actually, for Ubisoft to kind of revisit it and bring it to new platforms and keep it updated. But
I don't know. It was on PlayStation Plus at one point, which is how I ended up getting it on PS3 after I lost my copy, my Xbox 360 copy when I lost my Xbox 360.
Right.
So it's been around for a while, and it's certainly, you can get it for really cheap, if not even for free on certain services. But I still think it's worth playing. I think it's a fun game. But I do think the PS3 version is the third version of it that I've played, and I think it's the worst. It runs poorly, just like you said. I completely agree with all that. Well, so maybe, not the best option.
Yeah, maybe if there's a Steam sale at some point, I'll keep my eyes peeled. Yeah.
That'd be nice, yeah. All right. Well, Karen, you've been waiting quietly, but let's get into what you've been playing, because I know you and Guillaume have both been playing a game, and it's a kind of game that makes sense that two people would. Are you taking turns? I guess that's probably the easiest way.
Well, I mean, we both have copies of the game, so we're both playing it on our 3DSs.
Yeah, that's ideal.
Actually, so I should probably interject here that I actually got, you know, the game through Club Nintendo, and a listener, after I kind of quote-unquote jokingly begged for someone's Club Platinum reward, and that's the last time I do that because I feel certainly very dirty doing it, having done it. But Twitter user Joe Bananas, which I believe that's his real name, gave me gave me a copy of Animal Crossing. So thank you, Joe. Thank you for all you do.
That's very kind. So you both have free copies of Animal Crossing New Leaf.
Yeah,
that's right.
That worked out pretty well. It did. So how are you liking it, Karen? Is this your first time playing it at all?
Well, the first time I saw it wasn't, I don't know when, it must have been a few years ago. I had a friend who had it for the Wii, and I played it, or I actually just saw her play it. And I thought, this is the most boring game. Like, I just, you know, she was just like, I mean, I like fishing games, you know, but because she showed me the fishing feature in the game, and I thought, oh, that's pretty cool. But all it was just, you know, the villager walking around, and I wasn't really taken with it. But then, when was it? We got Tamodachi Life a little while ago, which I know that some of you
might have, a year ago now.
Might have a dim view of that. that kind of game. I don't know.
Guillaume certainly raised my opinion of it just through, you know, secondhand, really, just hearing him talk about playing it with you and how you had these little, you know, like inside jokes going back and forth, and
oh yeah,
you know,
I mean, it definitely
neighbors' babies and all kinds of weird stuff like that.
I didn't have the neighbor's baby. No,
no, he did.
Oh, he did. Yeah, probably. That's very
surprise.
Likely. So I played that, and I did enjoy that. I mean, but I don't think I would have enjoyed it if I wasn't playing it with Guillaume. So this is, I mean, I feel like this is sort of a similar type of game where. You know, really, this shows you how much I've changed in a few years, but I told Guillaume, this is the kind of game that I like to play, which is just, you know, I like the sort of, continuous reward system that's built into the game where, you know, you can buy stuff. It's kind of scary, actually. It sort of feeds into this, this capitalist craving, I guess, that's sort of buried deep within me just to keep acquiring things. It's very much an acquisitive kind of game. You're rewarded for acquiring things, which, you know, I don't like the idea of that, but when I'm playing the game, I easily forgive it because I find it so enjoyable.
But you know, you want that bigger house. You know it.
And the additions, and, you know, eventually I think you can get a castle. I don't know.
Yeah. maybe you know that. Who knows?
Maybe I know that. But yeah, so I mean, you know, the thing I like about the game is just the, you know, just that it does seem to reward you constantly. I mean, it's not a challenging game. You can figure it out pretty easily. You know, I like the banter between the villagers and my character, and as Guillaume said, I haven't taught anyone dirty words yet, but that might be in my future. So far I think the funniest thing I created, actually no, it was Guillaume who suggested this. My one character who's a penguin, he suggested that the greeting should be ice, ice, baby. So now that's what it says. And every time I go in, I forget that I've taught it that. And so it always makes me laugh because, you know, vanilla ice. But anyway, so
said.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, I mean, the feature that's built into it, you know, that I say it builds into that kind of. I just like that there's new things every time I open the game. It's just there's something new. It's not too challenging. It's pretty rewarding in terms of what you can get.
Yeah, it's very similar in a lot of ways to a lot of. Games that are now like free to play mobile phone games. It's just without the microtransactions.
Yeah, which
but the loop of what you're doing of you know, gathering all these items and customizing your character and the actions that you're doing are very simple and straightforward. It's really mostly a matter of sort of repetition and being there at the right time of day or playing it the right number of times per day.
Right.
You know, it's
right.
It's a very simple recipe for addiction. And when you take all of the, you know, the wildly diverse consumable items and five different kinds of currency and all the prompts for you to go and spend real money on it. You take all those little obstacles out of the path, and in Animal Crossing, it becomes very pure, you know, and you there's nothing to distract you from just continuing this cycle. And I think that's why people end up spending so much time on it.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know that I'll, you know, it might be a game like Tamodachi Life where I just sort of, after a while, I lose interest and, you know, I've sort of reached my plateau of how much I can acquire and how much, you know, I can talk to my villagers and things like that. I don't know. But it's the first time I've ever played through this kind of game. So I don't know what my threshold is.
Yeah, whereas I've played the GameCube version back in the day, so I kind of had my fill of that for a long time. Mm-hmm. Now I'm playing this, and I'm trying to play it more like, you know, when the GameCube game came out, Nintendo said, oh, this is a communication game. You're supposed to share your memory card with people. You're supposed to visit their towns or send them fruit through codes and stuff like that. And never really worked because, you know, like you heard communication game back then, you thought, okay, the internet, and Nintendo didn't know what the internet was. So yeah. It didn't really work.
It's so cumbersome. Now, you had to be in like a very specific kind of living situation to really, yeah. You know, like we always hear from people who played it in the dormitories. And for them, it was this life-changing, amazing thing that all their friends, you know, did with them. And you can see the allure of that, but it's so such a specific situation in which you can really make use of that kind of thing.
Right. And I had played a DS game, and that was online, but I lost interest very quickly because it seemed to be the same game, but online. So it didn't really work. But this time, you know, enough years have passed that I kind of feel nostalgic about the game. And also, it's a little bit easier to just connect to Karen's DS and visit her town. So I'm trying to do little stuff like write the animals, you know, letters. And it doesn't really, you know, of course, they don't understand what you write. But I know that eventually they're going to show the letters to Karen. So I'm, you know, I'm kind of, again, just like in Tomodachi Life, coming up with like in jokes and stuff like that. Or at some point I was like, I don't know, like thank you, Karen, for the slingshot that I couldn't buy in my own town. But have you accepted the Lord into your heart? And I don't know, like I was presentizing just as a... Anyway, like just, you know, stupid stuff like that. So that's where my interest right now
stupid
is.
Stupid stuff like God, yes.
No, but you know, just... Yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry if I've offended anyone.
Send your emails, too.
All right. Well, that sounds great. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a game that didn't quite grab me the way I was hoping. But I think, you know, and I told Guillaume this last year after all the talk about Tomodachi. I said, you really should check out Animal Crossing because it sounds like you would be the perfect couple for it. You know, I'm glad to hear that it's hitting home. Let's move on right now to James and what he's been playing.
Yeah, so start with the now recently moved to final. I guess we're out of beta. Final implies they won't be making any changes to it. Kerbal Space Program, which is on Steam and Good Old Games and every other way you can possibly obtain it. I've never talked about it on the show, but Johnny, I'm pretty sure you did at one point, right?
Not really. I've seen some of it played, but actually. It might have been that we got an email about it from a listener.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Because I think someone actually bought this game for me on Steam, or maybe they just highly recommended it. I put it on my wish list and ended up picking it up in a Christmas sale or something.
Yeah.
But I know I've had it on my computer, on my Steam account, for probably at least 2 or 3 years, and I've never opened it a single time. And I feel bad because I know a lot of people who love it, including like people I work with, you know, like Geeks who are just... Oh, they spend, you know, hours and hours and hours tinkering in it.
Yeah, and I've only spent 6 hours and 2 days in it. So potentially, yes, the engineer in me has become a problem. And there is a basically the idea of it is you are essentially the administrator of this essentially a space program for these creatures, these little green creatures on this planet. Who essentially have nothing. They have little rockets, and you have to get them all the way up through research and through, you know, funding drives and all the fun of running a government space agency to getting them into orbit around planets far out in their solar system. And it is a very, you know, not incredibly sophisticated, but a very solid model representing both the physics and engineering challenges of doing exactly that. So there's a lot of opportunity for your rockets to just blow up on the launch pad, which I've done a bunch of times. And as an administrator, that costs you money. So your biggest concern isn't the fact that you lost the pilot. It's that, damn it, that's a lot of money I just spent. So there's a lot of just this kind of experiment. It's basically a game that just preys off the desire to experiment and giving you both rewards for being successful. And there's that the ever-present, like, that almost was as good as I think it could be. Let me see if I can make it just a little bit better. And that it's that feedback loop I've talked about in other games that makes me obsessive about things, and this game has really high potential there. But basically, you have all these parts, and you get more parts as you do research, and you build rockets and space planes, and you build satellites you can launch into space, and you build space stations you can dock with, you build landers and land on other planets. I'm not that far yet. I've gotten something in orbit after 5.5 hours straight, basically, of tinkering with the same design.
So that's no small feat.
Yeah, it's hard. Like,
the thing is, that's not like the first level. I mean, you're kind of shooting up sounding rockets, right? Just high altitude.
Oh, I put somebody on it because I'm a monster. Somebody's on that first rocket.
You're ice cold, James.
Yeah.
At some point, you're getting to suborbital flight, which is you're in space, but you can't stay in space because that's a whole other level of energy that you got to put into it. And so it's like, I don't know how subtly, because I've, you know, the versions I've seen, I think were kind of accelerated or someone really knew what they were doing.
Right.
But I feel like it's the physics are fairly realistic. They're just kind of very scaled to make them a little bit cartoony. But relatively speaking, you know, like the mass of this thing that you're building is proportional to the energy that its imaginary rocket engines are putting out. You know, it's doing some math in a consistent deterministic way to determine how that thing is going to perform. And so being able to tweak that constantly and get like instant feedback and all seeing all the hilarious lemming style death animations of these little guys is great.
So, and there's things like the game gives you all these physics indicators. So, like you can see like the center of lift, the center of mass, the center of thrust is on all of your designs before you launch them. So, you know, I don't have any aerospace engineering background. I have lots of engineering, you know, course material that I've done. But this, you know, this is not something that I have experience with. So I'm trying to figure out how
it's a specialized field.
Yeah, I'm figuring out how these elements influence what this thing is going to do. And I'm primarily doing it through, all right, I've got this design. Let's see what happens. Oh, God, it's spinning. What happened? Okay, that's a problem. And so you can't just reset and go right back to the build room and just get right back to work on making the changes you want to make. And there was, to your point, like the first attempt to get into orbit, like when I really sat down and said, all right, I'm building a brand new, starting, like every rocket was an evolution of the previous design. Finally I said, this thing won't do it. I got to start over. And that was just like 3 hours on fire. Like that was just gone. And I'm dead to the world. Everything became this incredible task. And, you know, first time I went straight up into the air and then came right back down and was destroyed just emotionally. Like, oh, I can't believe this is how this is going to go. And eventually you figure out all the nuance in both design and in piloting, because ultimately you're controlling this thing. You have to execute turns in orbit or in space to get into an orbital trajectory. You have to figure out what that looks like. You kind of have to prep for it during the flight up and adjust throttle accordingly. There's a lot of little micromanagerial things here that can really get somebody who's obsessive about this stuff deep, deep involved. And what's scary to me is that I'm looking at things that people have launched on vehicles they have built, and you know they've launched components of space stations on semi-reusable platforms.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and like
I love that it lets you go that far.
And like they're just delivering pieces to a space station that they've got in space.
And I guess you mentioned before, but at some point the goal is to actually carry a Kerbal to another planet.
Yes. I have, giving all the thrust I can build with the current technology available to me, I have gotten 1/10 of the way to the Kerbal Moon. And that is, you know, hugely closer than the next planet. I mean, it's fairly representative of what, you know, our solar system looks like. And so it is a long ass way to the next thing. I can't fathom people who have gone way far out and have managed to pull, because there's time scales too. So these people who are really good at this game have, you know, 5, 6, 7 missions going at the same time, because ultimately they're flying out to a planet, you know, way far downrange. And so they have to do other stuff just because you're an agency, just to keep money coming in, keep getting in.
So you are running the program, not just designing.
You are
the space program.
Like you are essentially doing things like, so there's like currencies you earn, like prestige, which you get obviously for accomplishing things. You get science, that is the name of the currency for doing experiments in space.
I got 5 science today.
Yes, I'm actually 0.1 science away from being able to buy the next degree of boosters, and it's making me crazy because I can't figure out where I get it.
Oh man, this sounds okay. this is, you're getting into some stuff I did not know about this game, or maybe they added it, you know, since the last time I looked at it.
It's
but this sounds fantastic.
I'm
gonna have to dig into
most
this.
Of what people show when they do it is they go into essentially the free build mode, which is there's no budget, everything's unlocked, go crazy.
Yeah, oh, all I ever see is somebody putting something into orbit.
Yeah, and
they're like, track my orbit.
Yeah, and like the first time you put something in orbit, I only got 1.5 rotations around the planet, but like that was. I was celebrating. Like, I was like, yeah!
Yeah.
I'm gonna get a beer.
That's like a John Glenn flight, you know?
Yeah, like, I went downstairs and opened, like, 2 beer at the same time. Like, I'm gonna need both of these. And just, like, it was... Because, I mean, that was, like, 4 hours of work on just tweaking this one new design. And then there's that thought process of, okay, this thing works, and I didn't fly that optimally. I bet I can get this thing better without doing any modification. So it... I may have... completely screwed up the next launch, but there is this concept of just constant iterative improvement that's really fun.
Yeah, that's cool. That progression is something I did not know was part of the game.
Oh yeah, it's
that's extremely enticing to me. I mean, I literally talk about this kind of stuff every day at work.
You know, like how
to advance the technology and get more money into it and all this stuff.
So like you're basically trying to earn prestige through accomplishment, and then there are things that convert prestige into funding. So if you're not earning any prestige, you're not earning any cash, which is fairly representative of what being a government agency is like. But yeah, it's really there is a high risk here for people who are, you know, engineering minded and obsessive about it to get lost in time. Just as a fair warning for anybody thinking about playing this game. The other game I want to talk about, and this was inspired by our conversation last week, specifically an email we got, and I'm blanking on who sent it. After we recorded last week, we got the question about what the Q Fund did, and we talked a little bit about what they accomplished. Actually, the question was about when Square Enix announced their return to the platform, and we sort of led that to the Q Fund conversation. But that made me think about Crystal Chronicles a lot. Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles on the GameCube, like a lot. And at some point this week, I just pulled up the soundtrack for that game, which I had remembered was really good.
It is.
And it is really, really good. And we
are referring to the original Crystal Chronicles.
The GameCube game. Okay. And that was when the Death Spiral kicked in. And that ended with me figuring out how to get the Wii set up back on my TV, get into GameCube mode without using any Wii remotes, which you can't do, so I had to find a Wii remote and repair it, and getting that game running on a fresh save and just starting from the beginning. And I had forgotten a lot about that game. I remember
you playing it by yourself.
So I played it by myself originally. I have a sister, and she was game to play it, but she wasn't good, and she wasn't very interested. Like, so she would sit down and play it for, you know, 15 minutes, but that didn't really get me very far. And she wasn't, to use the phrase again, optimally controlling the character she had. So I realize, though, that game's a decade old. So there are people listening to the show who probably don't really know that much about it. They may know the name because it led to the creation of a bunch of Crystal Chronicles games. But basically, it's a little bit like a Gauntlet game in a lot of ways. You control a party, well, you control a single character, and in a real-time combat, killing a bunch of monsters and exploring dungeons, ultimately until you find a boss and kill it. It is essentially kind of like a simplified Gauntlet style game. Basically, the premise is you're in this world that's covered in miasma, and you have to get this magical tree water to keep the miasma at bay. I mean, it's dumb stuff, but essentially how that manifests in the game is there's this, we refer to it as the bucket, but the game calls it the chalice, that sort of projects a bubble to keep you safe. If you step out of it, you start taking damage. So in multiplayer, somebody has to hold that thing the whole time, which is where we get the carrying the bucket phrase. But essentially, you're just going through these dungeons and killing monsters and picking up items that are then sort of handed out by the game as awards for performance at the end. So it's not competitive for collecting items like the Zelda connectivity game, Four Swords.
Right.
So this game sort of is infamous because it required 4 GBAs, 4 link cables, you know, and obviously the game. If you played it single player, you didn't have to go through that. So I've only played it multiplayer a little bit. I'm not going to play very much this game. I think, you know, I did 3 or 4 dungeons. I think that's fine. It's just, you know, it's an interesting game world they created. Like, come from nothing, the whole world of Crystal Chronicles, where they've created these races that have all these distinct skills. It has a very distinct art style. The presentation for a GameCube game is pretty sharp. You know, we already spoke about the music. There's this weird thing at the start where this woman with Scottish accent talks about non sequiturs at the start of every level for some reason I don't understand. I'd forgotten about that. So when the first one rolled, I'm like, whoa, what? What is this? It's a neat game. It would be an interesting retroactive candidate for us, but the fact that to play multiplayer requires so much hardware makes it difficult. I think it has some very interesting and neat ideas.
Well, it's coincidentally, I got this game like last month.
Really?
And wow. I'm just thinking of, I just need to find a deal on a GBA and some link cables.
Yeah, just hit eBay up. That's where I got mine. It's, I understand. So the reason that it is on the GBA, not just because the Q Fund's primary mission was to sell connectivity, but how the equipment works in this game, you equip spells with your items you find in the stage. You get them from enemies, you pick them up, and then you have to equip them to your essentially active roster of moves. So it's attack and defend, and then, you know, some number of slots of magic. And so you're constantly going in there to shuffle them up for the kinds you need. So if you're playing single player, that's fine, do it on the screen. If you're playing multiplayer, the game's still going on while you're in those menus. So the rest of the team...
It doesn't pause.
Right, the rest of the team can still see the action. Your menu isn't eating up the whole screen because you're doing it on your Game Boy. I think you could go into houses too when you're in town. So everybody could do their shopping trips while they were in town. You'd have to wait for everybody to finish up their stuff. It's kind of a light use for that stuff, but I mean it has a place.
Well, that's not the only thing it's used for though. I mean, to me, the best, most evil psychological part is that each player gets a special objective.
Oh, that's right.
That's only shown to them. And sometimes they may actually be in conflict. So, you know, your screen might say, get the most coins. And someone else might be to also get the most coins or to like collect the same spell over and over again. And sometimes what you'll find out is at the end of the stage, once it actually reveals what everyone's secret objective was, that actually goes back to explain some of people's behavior. You know,
yeah,
like
you break out
into this little micro argument about, hey man, I was going to go get that, you know, and these little fights break out, which are a lot of the fun. But what you find out later is a lot of that is fueled by these secret objectives that you can only see on your GBA screen.
Right.
So I think that's pretty brilliant. And that was one of those things that made me really sad that connectivity never quite worked out.
And that's sort of the way this game brews misanthropic behavior versus Four Swords, which is just, I'm going to get all the money. Because essentially how this game does it is you can get all the items, but they're portioned out at the end to whoever the game has deemed the winner. So you may not get this item even if you pick it up. And so how it does this in single player, it just doesn't tell you what your objective is. I mean, you're going to win the item anyway because you're the only person playing. But
sure.
But like, so I had one earlier that I got no points on because my objective was pick up no items, which means you can't carry the bucket, you can't pick up items on the ground, which means that essentially anybody you can't use magic because you have to pick up magic at every stage, which means if you were playing with other people, they'd think you're terrible at this game and also kind of a jerk for not taking your turn with the bucket. So they're, yeah, these could make people really mad at you. Like, I enjoy this game. I did not beat it playing it single player because I don't think you can beat the last boss single player.
That game gets insanely hard towards the end.
It does. And I got to the final boss, but I don't think it can be beaten with one person because it does stuff that's just really hard to both. You're constantly dodging and healing and attacking. And if you're playing by yourself, there's no one to revive you when you go down. If you're playing with multiple people, you can revive each other and sort of go back and forth. So I think, you know, it's just very complicated to do it on your own. What I like about this game, you know, is that it is kind of this simple, there is kind of a, you know, simple qualities about it. It presents very well. What I kind of am bummed out about it is that it didn't do a very good job building out this world they've created, which is kind of interesting. But then they went and released all these games in this same world for, you know, about 6 years. They released about five or six more games based in the Crystal Chronicles world that do a really good job sort of fleshing out this stuff. So I'm kind of sad to see that they just unceremoniously dropped it. I mean, they spent a lot of time discussing, you know, giving characterization to these different races that they showed, and most of it in the first game, just in the manual. Like, oh, this is a race of thieves and wild savages. Well, in this other game, you get to see what that means for them. Like, they're just awful people to be around.
Have you played some of those later Crystal Chronicles games? I always felt like they were coming out, but I never knew anybody who was
I played My Life as a King, which I spoke about on the show. It was launch game. Yeah, I love that one. I played My Life as a Dark Lord, which came out a few years after that.
Sure. Yeah, I played that. It's pretty good.
I enjoyed that game a lot. I played The Crystal Bears, which was their single player, very story heavy game. I remember when it got announced, it kind of seemed like, oh, maybe this is finally sort of the realization of Square Enix returning to Nintendo consoles that we had talked about. Like, because it looked like a high production value, because they showed video. That was how they entered that game.
Right.
And like, oh, this has Final Fantasy qualities to it. Yeah. That game's
then
not
we
very...
found out it's basically the bouncer.
That game's not very good.
I mean, it's absolutely beautiful and you know, it just, there's not much game to it. You know, there's just the parts that you play are really
weird
and confusing and simple.
There's a lot of running around the game world.
Yeah.
But the other games that came out was that Wii game that was also on DS, and the DS game was really just the Wii game was really just the DS game on your TV.
Basically, like emulated.
I never played that one, but that's the only one I didn't play. Like, I do kind of want to go back and replay some of those. I spent a lot of time in My Life as a King. I ended up buying all the major races DLC, and you know, over the course of 3 or 4 years, like, it's just a fun game. It's kind of a shame they've just sort of abandoned that little sub-franchise, because a lot of neat... it was sort of a blank template they could throw a gameplay idea against and just let it go. And just say, okay, whatever we want out of this.
But not really whatever they want, because the problem with Crystal Chronicles is that it turned into... this could become anything related to Final Fantasy except the part of Final Fantasy that you actually want.
Right.
These games could look like anything except a normal ass Final Fantasy game, which is what everybody wanted in the first place.
Sure.
So I it's tough to stand up to that legacy and to keep disappointing people that it's yet another real-time action game or crazy interactive cinematic game or whatever Crystal Bears is, you know,
a city
or some
building
weird,
game.
Yeah, or, you know, a tower defense game, essentially, with Dark Lord. So, I mean, yes, some of these are good games. They're all kind of interesting in their own ways, but none of them are really Final Fantasy.
No, they aren't.
And that's the problem, is that none of them play like the Final Fantasy games that everybody, you know, was really the most interested in and that remembered from before. They gave that brand its identity.
Let's just say they took those two words off all of those games. Never had them.
If it was just called Crystal Chronicles.
Right, and then every subsequent game had the same title that it has now, sub minus Final Fantasy. Like, I think...
It would be seen very differently.
It would be. Because every single one of the games that came out, with the exception possibly of that Wii DS emulated monstrosity, has interesting ideas in it. And I like that they created a series and they built a world that they just said, we can put whatever kind of weird gameplay idea we want to experiment with in this and just call it and just do what we want to do with it. In that way, it's kind of a shame that it's not around anymore, because ultimately I like that Square Enix had this template they could experiment in. And I enjoyed, in some way or another, almost all of the games that I played in that series.
Well, you know what I think is really the successor? And we haven't talked about it that much on the show because none of us have it, but Final Fantasy Explorers, I think, it's only in Japan right now, but it's the real-time action Final Fantasy game that I've heard very good, and similar to, in some respects, to Crystal Chronicles, some similarities to Monster Hunter, based on pretty traditional Final Fantasy tropes. You know, you've got the white mage, you've got the black wizard, you've got all that stuff, chocobos and whatnot. I'm still very curious to hear if that's coming out in the West, because it sounds great. I mean, I'm definitely curious about it.
Their willingness to subvert some of those tropes, I think, is kind of what I liked about that game, or at least part of it.
Yeah.
They stumbled into kind of an interesting world design, and it is a shame that ultimately, most of the games that came out didn't focus on that anymore. But, you know, I mean, it's cool. It's a neat artifact of a game. And if you can get your hands on some GBAs and some people to play that game with, it's a weird time to have. I mean,
yeah, you're going to put some effort into kind of getting together this little Crystal Chronicles party, but it'll pay off, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it'll
to some extent.
Do prep some characters before the start, just because last time I played it with people and I didn't have characters ready to go, we spent an hour just determining, you know, what does it mean if I'm a Lilty and my father was a ranger. Yeah. I don't care. Just pick the character and go. Let's get this over with. Come on.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on and we'll talk to John about what he's been playing recently.
All right. Well, I decided to Johnny. I was in the mood for something. I was in the mood for puzzles. But ooh. I was also in the mood for dragons, though. So what's a boy to do?
I've got just the thing for you.
Oh,
so you played a Mario demo.
Oh,
this all game three. Is both puzzles and dragons.
Yes,
and Mario.
And a little bit of Mario in there. Yes, I played the official name is the Puzzle and Dragons Z or Z for Guillaume.
Thank you.
Super Mario Brothers Edition demo. So yes, so I wanted to check this out because I mean. Yeah, this is a smartphone game that's brought to the 3DS, made by Gung Ho. I've never played it on smartphone because, you know, these kinds of games really are not my bag.
I actually talked about it on the show.
Yes, I remember that.
I talked about the subversive economics of it specifically.
Mm-hmm. Because of course you would. Of course you would.
But there's none of that in the 3DS game.
No,
you just
no,
buy
no.
the whole game. Actually, no. You get two games for one.
Yep, so this is the Super Mario Brothers edition that was just put up on the eShop, the demo of it. And it gives you kind of an intro level and an expert level. And what this game is, for those that don't feel like going back and listening to James again, I don't blame you, is...
Who would?
So on the bottom screen, on the touch screen, you have a view of effectively a Super Mario kind of scrolling obstacle course style. That has little icons on it for enemies that you will fight moving from left to right up to a boss character. So your little guy is on a stick and he moves along and he runs into an enemy icon. And then on the top screen is where you're it's like you're walking through a 3D version of the little obstacle course thing and the enemies come at you. They come towards you. Or they're really flat sprites kind of. But the battle is fought up on the top screen, and you move around the gems or whatever you want to call them. They're various shapes like, you know, dark mushrooms and leaves and stuff like that, and you match them on the bottom screen. And when you match, you have a five-character party. Each one of those characters has, I guess, what you could call, they match the little gems on the bottom screen. And when you eliminate the gems on the bottom screen... Your characters in your party that match those gems, that match the icon, they attack. So that's kind of the general gist of things. And of course, you can. The more you clear off, you know, more gems drop onto the bottom screen, and you get combos, which leads to more attacks, more powerful attacks against your enemies, and you know, combos and you know, attacks and stuff like that. So it's interesting. I mean, it's a puzzle game. You know, kind of reminds me of Puzzle Quest from back in the day a little bit. It does have light RPG elements. Your characters have experience points, and as you go through battles, you know, they you know, increase in experience and, you know, gain new powers and stuff like that. Or I'm assuming they gain new powers. And you can also, you have kind of a leader power and a helper power. You select which you can, I guess you can get a whole bunch of different characters to select from. I think in the demo, you can choose from, I believe it's a Mario Boo, and then the helper for him is another kind of like, I think a Luigi Boo.
Yeah.
So it's yep. And the other one, I can't recall what the other one is. I think it's just Mario and Luigi, Super Mario and Super Luigi. And the way that they differ is the teams that they have, they each have a team of five characters each, and they differ in the kind of like the gems that they react to. So
yeah,
I think
their color affiliation.
Yeah. So I think the for Super Mario and Super Luigi, I think their team happens to be all water gems. So you know, they're, when you clear out those types of gems, you pretty much have to go for those ones exclusively. Whereas mm-hmm. some of the other teams that have kind of mixed elements, like some of them react to dark mushrooms, some of them react to water, some of them react to the fire plants and stuff like that. So you kind of have to, you kind of switch your, the way your team is composed determines kind of which gems that you focus on clearing out. So, you know, as you kind of move forward through the course, you eventually get to the boss and, you know, you fight the boss. He has, you know, you have your life bar and the boss has his life bar, just as like all the battles are like that. You're constantly trying to just, you know, launch these attacks against the enemies that you're facing and get their health down to zero, move on to the next enemy. It's pretty cool. I mean, it's one of the things that always bothers me about these kind of games is it seems very random. It seems like you're kind of at the mercy of RNG a little bit. Just because you have no control over what gems get dropped onto the field of play. So you can set off a combo, and sometimes you'll sit there and watch 10 combos kick off, and you really had nothing to do with it. You just happened to.
Boom, battle's over.
Exactly. Yeah. And then sometimes that won't happen, and you'll get your ass handed to you. So, and I mean, there's quite a difference between intro and expert. Expert's very challenging.
Huge difference. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've found myself dying a lot on expert, and I don't know if I've actually beaten expert all the way through.
I could not, and yeah, I tried several times with both teams.
Yeah,
you know,
so
completely
did I.
Mixing up the tactics, trying different things, mm-hmm. use the skills some. Nothing really seemed to be working all that well, and I just kept thinking, man, I kind of wish there was an intermediate, because the intro level is piss easy, and you don't really learn anything from it. And then you get to expert, and it feels like you don't have the tools, like you don't actually understand what's going on well enough to compete in these battles. So I really felt like there was kind of something missing in the middle, and I bet it's there in the final game. Mm-hmm. But in the demo, I found the expert difficulty to be kind of just inscrutable. You know, I didn't even understand why I was doing badly.
Yeah, I mean, even on expert, I mean, when I kind of backtracked and started to focus solely on healing my characters, I was still getting wiped out. There didn't really seem to be any pattern, because sometimes I would focus on healing and get wiped out, and then there was other times when I wouldn't focus on healing at all. I would just completely abandon it, and I would do really well and almost win.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was kind of all over the place. So you're absolutely right, Johnny. I mean, I hope that there's some kind of intermediate here.
Doesn't feel, you know, if you're thinking of Puzzle Quest and you know, games like that where it seems like a very similar concept, I would say from what I have experienced in this demo, which is also my only exposure to Puzzle and Dragons, but this feels less strategic. Mm-hmm. It feels a little more parlor gamey, you know, like more random, like you talked about, a little more slot machine-like, which is a huge turnoff for me. So I actually came out of the demo saying, yeah, this, it's neat, but it's not satisfying enough for me to play many, many hours of it.
Yeah. What surprised me and what I thought was, and what kind of, you know, lends itself to that type of gameplay is the fact that you can move around the gems anywhere you want. I was very used to, at first I started playing it like Puzzle Quest, because in Puzzle Quest, I think you can only move one, like kind of like one square over.
Yeah, you're just switching.
That's what I was used to. So that's all that I was doing to start out with. But then I looked back, because what it does when you come in is it'll show you, it'll kind of have like an attract mode sort of thing where it just kind of plays a game on its own. So you can watch what it's doing. And I saw that you could actually move the gems anywhere you wanted on the game field. And I was like, the hell. So, you know, that helps. I mean, you know, because it lets you, you know, look and you can see, you know, you can do more than just kind of like connecting three at a time sort of thing. But that's kind of, it's really fast and loose. Like, I don't know. It's hard to describe, because it just seems like, because you can kind of move gems anywhere, it makes it feel more random. Like, it's almost like you have less of an effect on gameplay, because you can just kind of do anything. So you can just move something all the way across the game board. And, hey, you know, we'll see what happens. You're kind of, it's almost the path, like gambling.
The path that you're taking matters, though. I didn't get good at the demo enough to actually manage to do this. But because when you displace one gem, it kind of I don't know, it switches place with all the gems in that path, you can kind of set up combos. You can trigger more than just the one, I don't know, you can destroy basically like a whole screen if you know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But that's the thing, like it's really hard to pull off, and I don't know.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, and I can see people like practicing that a lot and getting good at it, but still what's happening there is you're basically deciding what color you want to match, and mm-hmm. if there's enough tiles on the board to make that happen, then you kind of just make the best out of getting the piece over to the other two to make the match. So then it's a matter of basically skill in very quickly navigating whatever route that you want to take, but it's still not really strategic in a grander sense.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I mean, nobody ever said Puzzle and Dragons was a strategy game, I don't think. I think it's considered more of just a straight-up puzzle game and maybe an RPG. But again, for me personally, it's just not as interesting as other things that look very similar to it. I mean, even Bejeweled, I think, takes a little more tactical thinking to kind of set up the things that you want. And Puzzle and Dragons just it feels not twitchy, but it
plays very fast.
Yeah, it's kind of designed that way.
Yeah, that's right. There is a timer on your moves, and I mean, the thing is too. It's like the game board is really. I mean, it's only like 5 gems high, so you have a very constrained sort of, you know, view to work within. You know, so it's like for me, I was, you know, with puzzle games like this, I'm used to being able to look, you know, maybe 10 gems high to see what's way, way up there, and then kind of piece together combos as they come down. But with this, I just kind of felt like you're really only looking at a very small play field. So, you know, I don't know. But
yeah, the icons are big, which is nice, you know, for readability, and you know, the presentation is very colorful and sharp, but they're so large that they can't fit very many on the screen. And when you play the game, I kept feeling like I sort of wished there were more tiles stacked up on the top screen.
Yeah,
so
do I.
So I could at least preview what's coming down, because I don't even really feel like I can set up good combos or anything like that, because you know, there's just the vertical space is so limited, like you said.
Yep. So.
It's a weird experience. I don't. Maybe this is not the ideal like introduction to Puzzle and Dragons. Maybe, you know, just downloading the phone game would give me a better sense of it. But I did not find the demo to be very effective in making the game appeal, at least to me. It actually kind of informed me that hey, maybe this is not something that you would enjoy that much.
Yeah, it really just makes me want to go back and play Puzzle Quest.
Yeah. Same here. Yeah, totally. So. There really should be like a downloadable Puzzle Quest for 3DS. Yeah. I want to say they did a DSiWare version.
I'm not aware of one.
Does that sound right? I mean, I think they did something like that later on where they made it downloadable. They certainly did on the consoles.
Puzzle Quest Challenge of the Warlords.
Well, that was the original game.
No, but it came out on DSiWare.
Oh, it did? Okay, good. Yeah, that's the same subtitle as all the other platforms, but yeah. Well, that's good. I don't know if that's a good version, but that'd be kind of nice to have around in your pocket all the time.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on, I will wrap up new business. Very quickly, I'll mention that I've been playing some Harma Knight, which I mentioned, I think, a couple months ago, getting on Club Nintendo with the last few of my coins. It's okay, I guess. It's an automatic runner game that was exclusive to 3DS, and I think it was made by someone who worked in the Pokemon developer. What are they called?
What, Game Freak?
Yeah, Game Freak.
Yeah,
thank you.
Game Freak made that game. Yes.
Yep. Yes, it's the Game Freak joint where they, you know, every now and then they break off and do something like Drill Dozer or whatever. Now they're doing that other game that's not coming to Wii U. Mm-hmm. PS4, Xbox One, and PC game, weirdly enough. But anyway, so Harma Knight, you know, came out a couple years ago. It seemed expensive at the time. It was like $15, and I think at the time it was the most expensive 3DS download-only game. Not that unusual nowadays, plus there's a lot more retail stuff competing nowadays, so maybe it doesn't seem as weird to me to spend $30, $40 on the eShop anymore, but at the time it did, and that's part of the reason I didn't get it. Now that I have Harmonite, I think it is it's a well executed rhythm game. You know, if you like a Bit Trip Runner a lot or Runner 2, it's similar to that. The musical cues are pretty strong, which I think they are in Bit Trip as well. And so a lot, the game, it's kind of a platformer. It's kind of a rhythm game, right? And I like that combination. And I think if you're having trouble, keeping up with the speed of the graphics, you can pay more attention to the music and vice versa. If you're not, if you don't have a great sense of rhythm or if it's just kind of off on a particular day, you can sort of focus on the graphics. You can sort of use either one to kind of help you and get through the stages. And it's not overly difficult or anything. It's got really nice art style. I'm not crazy about the music, but the other thing I want to mention is that these boss battles that you get into every three or four stages, you have a mini boss or an end of the world boss on these goofy little Mario 3 style or Super Mario World maps that the game takes place on. And the boss stages are completely different than the normal stages. You're no longer like running along a path and, you know, trying to collect all the notes. It's, you know, it's much more of a Rhythm Heaven style thing where it's very cinematic and the boss is launching attacks at you. And then you just have to hit a button day, A, you know, to some weird little quirky beat. And the graphics at that point will not help you really. Because the patterns are coming in really, really fast. And there's no artifice of platforming or anything like that. And it's not even really about paying attention to the music anymore because, you know, it's much more about these little brief, sharp, sets of notes that you're trying to keep up with. And I think these levels are really bad. I don't enjoy them at all. They feel very different from the other levels in the game and not in a good way. They actually kind of take away a lot of the things that I really like about the normal levels.
They don't feel as precise. It feels
they're also just way harder.
To the point that
they're frustrating and they feel like roadblocks.
Well, there's a lot of memorize the pattern in there, and sometimes those patterns get quite long, and it doesn't feel like it's set to music the same way. So it's
exactly.
much more a
there's
matter
not
of
so much of a continuous tempo going through the stage as there is in the other levels. So yeah, that's kind of kept me from really being all that enthusiastic about Harmonite. I mean, I think there's a lot to like about it, but you know, the music isn't that great for me. I mean, if I think of this as mostly a rhythm game, then I would want the music to be really good. You know, I thought in the Bit Trip games, both of them, although very different styles really between them, I thought both of them had really excellent soundtracks and the music was super catchy and I wanted to keep listening to it. In Harmonite, it feels kind of like watered down Pokemon music, sort of. I mean, it's not anything like really super catchy and awesome. So that definitely, you know, kind of washes out the appeal of the game, and it's too bad. But you know, I do think some people will love it, especially if you're more attuned to the soundtrack, the style there than I am. I think you'll get a lot more out of it. If you really love Rhythm Heaven, you know, I'm not that big of a fan of Rhythm Heaven. So these boss stages that feel straight out of that series kind of don't do it for me. But if you're really into Rhythm Heaven and you have no problem with that stuff, maybe they're better suited for you. It's okay. I'll say I do want to keep playing it. I like the graphics a whole lot. I think the story's funny. And I like most of the levels quite a bit. I don't love them, but yeah, they're fun to play through and I want to keep going. But every time I hit a boss, I'm like, oh man, I'm going to have to play this like 20 times to get through it. And it's just not, you know, I don't like the game enough to really put up with all that. So yeah, I'm kind of ambivalent on it. But I do want to talk, super quickly about another game I played just because it's so weird. And I bet you guys remember a couple years ago, hearing about Typing of the Dead Overkill, which was a PC game.
Oh yeah.
Yep.
It came out of nowhere. Like this game wasn't announced. And then one day Sega just dumps it on Steam.
Well, it was originally, I believe it came out in arcades in Japan because Sega,
Sega, so bizarre.
Sega in arcades in Japan are insane.
Straight up keyboards in Japanese arcades.
Yes.
And typing weird little phrases. But, Typing of the Dead Overkill is a sequel to Typing of the Dead, which was on Dreamcast, which I've never played. I just thought it sounded really funny. It's obviously based on House of the Dead, and the idea is that instead of shooting a light gun at your screen, you have a keyboard, and these phrases pop up on the screen over the zombies as they're coming at you. And as they shamble along and get closer and closer, you're kind of, you know, under the heat to type out this phrase accurately. And once you complete the phrase or the word, the zombie will go down. And you're furiously typing. And it's a great psychological effect because, you know, as you see zombies start to, you know, get closer and closer, it's natural that you're going to feel more anxious. And of course, the more anxious you are, the more difficult it is to type accurately, which is really the name of the game here. So it's a fun tension between, you know, what you're seeing and what your fingers are doing. It feels very different to play a game like this than it does other video games. But I'll say also, it doesn't feel like work. You know, I mean, I type a lot at my job, and playing this game does not feel like I'm at my job. It still feels like I'm playing a video game. It just feels like I have this weird controller that feels awkward and unfamiliar, and yet I seem to know exactly how to use it.
So this game is clearly
a strange feeling.
It's clearly used to train journalists in combat zones that need to use typewriters, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a super goofy game, but it works and it's fun, and it doesn't, you don't need like a beastly computer to run it. So it has that going for it. It ran fine on my, basically tablet. And this is Typing of the Dead Overkill, of course, the new one. So it is based on the House of the Dead Overkill, weird, campy, like B movie 70s grindhouse version of House of the Dead,
which is pretty darn good.
It's pretty good, yeah. I'm not the crazy fan of it that some people on our staff are, but it has a huge following. The people who love that game really, really love it. I found it amusing and a fun rental, which I would say is high praise for a light gun game, because a lot of them I don't even find worth, you know, continuing to play through. But anyway, regardless of what you think of House of the Dead Overkill, it's generally considered a good game and an interesting game and a funny game. You know, with these crazy stereotypical characters who curse at each other constantly and get into these really gross situations. And, I was a little disappointed to find that Typing of the Dead Overkill is basically just a remake of that game, but with typing.
Well, I mean, the original Typing of the Dead was that exactly.
Okay. Well, then maybe this is part of tradition. I've never played the original.
I think it was like part of the joke, though. They'd put you in like super high tense situations where you're shooting zombies and have you typing like flower names.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the phrases that come up are not entirely random. You can tell that there's some thought put behind it. At least part of the time, they will throw phrases at you that seem weirdly appropriate for the situation or weirdly out of place, like in a kind of a deliberate way. That's just too perfect to be random. So I really like that about it. But yeah, I mean, a lot of the game is watching cutscenes because it's a light gun game originally. And that was very much the case on the Wii when I played this with my Wii remote pointing at the screen instead of a keyboard. And, you know, the cutscenes, I will say, don't hold up that great a few years later. And especially if this is not the first time you've seen them. They don't seem nearly as funny the second time around. It's kind of like going to see Scary Movie 4. You might chuckle in the theater, but you're not going to want to rent that and watch it again 6 months later at home. It's just not going to hold up that well. And that's kind of how I feel about the story scenes of House of the Dead Overkill. You can put typing over that, but you're still spending a lot of time in the game being with these dumb characters and hearing the same, you know, kind of okay jokes over again, and the cursing just feels like, yes, over the top and often like put in deliberately inappropriate parts of the sentence, you know, like people don't even phrase correctly when they're using curse words. They just kind of drop it in weird places that don't make sense, but it's just not that funny anymore to me. But I never found it like uproariously funny in the first place, and some people did, so I suspect they'll have a little bit different reaction to it. But I do think the game's fine. Just for me, I played one level of it, and I'm like, okay, I see what this is. I don't need to play through House of the Dead Overkill again. I had enough of it the first time, so I'm done with it, but I enjoyed it for sure. And you can get it for a song on Steam nowadays. At one point, I think I might have even paid like 99 cents for this game. So it's, you know, it's not expensive or anything. It's a fun little thing. So, we're now going to take a break, and when we come back, we've got some listener mail.
Well, we got to say goodbye to Karen.
Oh, that's right. Karen, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you continue to enjoy Animal Crossing.
I will. Thank you for having me. And I think the next time I'm on, I'll be talking about Chrono Trigger, which I know is something you want me to do. So.
Oh, yeah.
It's no Final Fantasy VI, but we'll take it.
Oh, my God.
That's fantastic. Well, all enjoy right. that. I know you will. I look forward to
hearing the game has taken the backseat to other stuff, including Animal Crossing. Yes, but
no, I told Guillaume that I have a reason for not continuing with it. It's just I want to fully enjoy the game, so I want to be able to devote my entire attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my excuse.
Well, I can't wait to hear about it. So thanks again, Karen, and we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, talk to you soon.
All right. Well, with that, we are going to wrap up this segment, take a quick break, and come back with some listener mail.
It's Now Playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Check it out, everybody, it's Now Playing on NWR, you know what I'm saying. Before we get into the content, let me just say, you know that you want it. Alright, first up, we got the Smash Brothers Tournament Finals. We're kicking it old school like the vinyl. Yo!
Behold, the epic conclusion of the tournament that hasn't been interesting since Team RFN left. You like items? Forget it. Humor? This is dry as a bone. Entertainment? That's in the eye of the beholder. All you get is no item smash, as God intended.
Yo, and coming up, we got another review. Shin Megami Tensei Devil Survivor 2 Record Breaker, just for you. It's on 3DS, and the review is by Donald. That's right. He's awesome like Ronald McDonald.
It's a combination of Fire Emblem and Mega Ten. If you don't know what any of those words mean, you won't care about Donald's review. But if you do, you probably have his entire review already tattooed on your back. So there's that.
Yo, and what's up? The next one is a feature. You're gonna read it, cause you're a creature. It's the best of Konami on Virtual Console. And you know it's pure gold.
Now that Konami is tanking, it's time to buy everything on VC before it goes away forever. Seriously, they're gonna torch their factories, hunt down all copies of existing games, burn them and kill their owners. Hoard their games on VC now in your Doomsday Bunker with the help of this guide.
Yeah, that feature was dope. I know you people at home can't even cope. The next one up is a preview. And I'll leave you other rappers see-through. This one's for Xenoblade Chronicles. You can't see me, you best to clear your monocles. Yo, it's written by Danny Bivins. So check out how my homeboy is living.
You know you want this game. I do. He does. She does. Your mom does. Your dog and cat probably do too. Danny gives you the lowdown based on his hands-on time with the Japanese version and clues you in on what you should do to boost the performance of this massive game. P.S. Your goldfish wants it too.
And that's it for this week. If you want to read the rest, go to NWR.com. You know the test. Yeah, this is Silky MC. I'm out. And if you eat fish, make sure that it's trout. Peace.
And we're back. Well, us four guys anyway. And we are ready for some listener mail. As always, the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. This is a normal set of listener mail. We'll take a little bit longer with these than we did last week. But I hope people continue to enjoy the Thunder Round. We'll keep doing it. Whenever we have enough questions of that particular variety. Yeah, once we've built up enough thunder. So anyway, Guillaume is going to read the first email this week.
Cobes Kill writes,
yes.
Lately, I've gone back and tried to put a dent into my backlog. Counting only from GameCube and up, I can tell you the backlog is in the hundreds, with console and handhelds combined. I've put a restriction on myself that for every new game I want to buy, I have to actually pass three of my backlog games. To complete three of my backlog games.
This is
nothing
folly.
Special, like 100%ing them, but just beat them from start to finish. It's kind of working so far, but with so many games and me having so little time to do a full-time job, two kids, 1 year and 3 years old. Oh yeah, and a wife who isn't too fond of my little hobby. She says it takes away from family time.
All that has to go.
It's very hard to work through that backlog. How big is your backlog, and what do you guys do about it, if anything?
This is a real question.
It's huge, baby. Trust me, it's huge.
Anytime you've got a big problem in your hands, you know, you have to sort of figure out what's important and what isn't. And I think in your case, what is important is you need to, you know, you need to just get rid of stuff that's not. So the job, the kids, the family, get that out of there.
It's about focus.
And just focus on these games, because that's what's important in life.
Oh, yes.
I think you'll find when you are unemployed and living alone that you get way more game time in.
That will be your legacy.
Yeah, I mean, people will say he had a backlog of hundreds of console and handheld games, and then he had a backlog of tens of consoles and handheld games, and then he died. Good for him.
Yeah,
they'll be like, you know, your tombstone. They'll make your tombstone out of the games you didn't finish.
Yeah, and they'll look at your the save files that you have, and they'll say, "Man, you 100%ed that. Ooh, he platinumed that." I mean,
no, because he's not doing that. They'll look at that and say, "The life he could have lived, what he could have done."
So, in all seriousness, that's a big backlog. I don't think it's unique or unheard of, and probably one or two of us are approaching it.
Oh, it's not unique.
Mine is real bad. I can say.
Mine too. But I think that one of the first things that you have to do is kind of stop looking at sales, because that's what's probably killing you. Like, I mean, that's probably, you've already got, tell yourself whenever you see a sale on a game that you think, well, that you've wanted to play and you think, oh yeah, now it's like, it's just $5. I have to jump on this opportunity. Tell yourself that you've got 100 other games that you can already play, that you've wanted to play enough at some point to actually buy them.
Yep.
And to just go back to that, like, stop paying. And it's hard to not spend when there's a big sale going on. There's like this feeling that you're going to be missing something.
That's how sales work.
Exactly. But just ignore them. Focus on the backlog, because you're already missing stuff that you own. Like, you've got all these experiences in your bookshelves or whatever, and they're just waiting for you to play them. So focus on that.
Yeah, and frankly, they're probably not that different from the games you're going to buy anyway.
Yes. Yeah.
So
yeah, that's one thing. Like, when I sometimes look at a game and that's coming out that's new, and sure, like, there's a lot of hype around it, but I think, wait, I could get Codename Steam. I could talk about it on a podcast, and you know, it's not terribly expensive, but I did pick up a cheap copy of the Valkyria Chronicles at some point, and it would probably be a good idea to play it. So, you know, that's how backlogs form. You see something, you want it, you can afford it, you pick it up, but then if you don't have the time set aside to actually play it, then you've wasted your money.
Yeah.
Well, you say wasted, but it's tough when you're talking about digital. Think of it this way. But I think part of this is that we get into a collecting mentality where the act of buying it especially at a good price, which for some of us makes it more appealing than buying at a high price. Some people it's the opposite, right? But for a lot of us, the act of buying the game, especially at a good price, sort of becomes the game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You end up feeling, you get some sense of satisfaction or some sense of value in your own collection growing a little bit better. You buy some game that a lot of people think highly of and that sounds cool, even though you might never actually have time to play it. And you like your life better having said, yes, I own a copy of that, than not, right? Or whatever. You think, maybe one day I'll play it.
You're like, boy, I didn't miss out on anything, so, you know, I'm good. It's like, I can at least say to my friends, hey, I got this game, I'll play it at some point, you know?
I don't know, John, how do you manage?
that's the thing. I mean, I
went crazy probably around like 2007, 2008 is when I was, when it was really bad. I was literally buying.
I remember.
We were trying to stop you.
I was buying like three or four games, like, and we're talking like PS3 games and 360 games at full price.
More than full price, because you were buying collector's editions a lot.
Yeah, collector's editions and everything. And that was, I mean, I was buying like four of those a month. And those, and you know what? Those, and that's the thing. That's what you have to remember. The game that you think that you can't live without, that game will probably end up on the backlog like everything else.
Mm.
Most of the time, that's the way it's going to work, because you'll play that game because you know what? 4 weeks will go by, you know, 6 weeks will go by. The next game will come out and you'll want to buy that one. And that will be the next game that you cannot miss.
Yep.
So you have
harsh
to like,
lesson.
Yeah. You have to like pull yourself out of that and just say like, if I don't buy this latest game that comes out, is it really going to matter? Because I know, I mean, I do that a lot where I'm just like, you know, yeah, I could buy this game. Like I do that with like, a classic example is, Advanced Warfare, you know, because I'm a big first person shooter fan. So I tend to buy most first person shooters that come out, but that game, I was kind of on the fence about it. And I had like about a week there where I was like, should I get, you know, cause they have like the prestige edition and this edition, that edition. And I was like, man, should I buy it? And then finally I just said, no, I'm not going to buy it. And I picked it up for $25 on sale. And at that, I mean, at $25, it's like, even if I don't play through it, whatever, I don't really care about it. You know what I mean? I didn't sink a lot of money versus paying like $80, $100, $120 for one of these collector's versions of it.
Right. Sure. Well, but you still end up with the backlog though. Cause I mean, in the end, you're buying a game that you probably won't ever play. So yes, it's good that you're spending less money on it, but I don't know that you're really addressing the root problem here.
Well, I will play through that at some point, but to me, I only spent $25 on it. So. Who cares?
Yeah, I don't know. I still think it's a problem.
I'm kind of the outside looking in on this one.
You don't really have a backlog, James.
It's about four games deep right now. And that's generally pretty normal for what it is.
Mm. Well, do you have a Steam backlog, though?
Not a huge one. So here's the thing about Steam. What I've done with Steam is I regard every game I buy on Steam as disposable. And that may mean
they pretty much are.
That may mean that I play them for an hour, for 2 hours, and maybe that's enough to talk about them on RFN, or enough to decide I don't want to do this anymore, and that's it. It's weird though, because Steam's the only conduit for game, you know, game delivery that I have this a high willingness to say this is a disposable experience. I don't need to play this anymore.
Yeah, well, on Steam, I have stuff like on Steam, like my Steam backlog is something stupid, like probably 120 games, but about 80 of those are I bought one of those like
the bundles.
Yeah, of like every single Doom game that's ever been made. So that's like 60 games on its own. It's like Quake, Hexen.
Oh yeah, I need to play Hexen right now.
To me, those are the honeypot for, you know, backlog prone people like yourself, John. And
yeah.
I always see those and I laugh because, you know, it'll be amazingly discounted. It'll be like, you could get every single Doom game
every
ever made.
Every Star Wars game on Steam.
For $20. Yeah, yeah, I think right now you can get not really every Star Wars game, but all the ones that are on Steam.
Yes.
For like $25. And it is a great deal.
It's
but
like 90 games or something stupid.
You'll never play, maybe none of them, but you definitely won't ever play all of them, and you probably won't even play. So I try to like actively avoid those because I can see what they're doing with it, and I just think, man, it's honestly a waste of money.
It is.
Like, for me, a Steam game, I play it almost as soon as I buy it. And it's gotta work right now. It's gotta work on me in some degree at this second, because not only do I get stuff in these bundles, but like, sometimes Steam just gives you something like, hey, this is your game now. And sometimes people, you know, people I know or will just gift me a game. And I'm like, where the hell did that come from? Oh, I got gifted it to me. Okay.
But Kobe Skills didn't even talk about Steam. It seems like it's all console games. And it seems like he wants to play through them to the end. And I think, James, that you touched on an important point. Like, you don't need to do that. You don't need to sit down and force yourself through a game. I hope that's not what he's doing. Like, I hope that if he's not enjoying a game, like, he's willing to put it aside. But, James, like you say that you only do that with Steam games. I would extend that personally to retail games and to console games. Like, I don't know. Like, I very quickly gave up on DK64 some the fans of that game would say too quickly, but really, like, I think I have a pretty fair idea of what the next 30 hours were going to be like.
But you have to have already bought those games at that point. See, in
yeah, but like at least I have the I slid the icon for DK64 to my garbage folder.
Oh, you have a garbage folder? Wow.
What are you, Don Koopman? What are you doing?
At least you have the satisfaction that it's not in your pile anymore. It's not weighing you down, you know?
You don't have to look at it every time you turn the system on.
When I buy games, and maybe this is the way you start to attack your backlog. When I buy games, it is with the expectation that I'm about to play that game now.
Right.
That, I always keep 1 to 2 games on hand, but expressly for the purpose of I do a weekly podcast where I talk about a new game every week. Like those are the, I don't have a time to go get something else or order something online. I'm just going to play something right now and there's something on the download space. So let's do this. But that sort of keeps you honest. You know, if you really want to play a game, you're going to buy it because you want to play it. But and you're planning to play it right now, it's not, I'm going to buy this and then I'll get to it later. Because ultimately, if you were ever really going to play that game and you don't buy it right now, you're going to constantly think about that game enough that you buy it later or somebody will remind you
that it
exists.
That's what I'm doing now with, Pillars of Eternity for PC.
Right, somebody will eventually remind you that game exists. You go, God, I really want to play that.
Yep.
I can play it now and buy it, and then you'll play it. So, like, I haven't bought Codename Steam yet. I will eventually. I might buy it this week. I have a trip coming up, but I knew I wasn't going to play it, so I've just kind of been waiting. I mean, the game will still exist in a year.
That's exactly it. You have to realize it's all about – this is like an exercise in self-control because – inevitably, at some point, you will have more money than time to play these games.
Yeah.
That game is not going anywhere.
Right.
It will be here 10 years from now. You'll be able to get a copy of that game and play it somehow.
But will you be, John?
That's true. That's deep, Johnny. That's deep.
That's true.
Shit just got real in this podcast.
I'm just trolling you.
If you're dead, you won't care that you didn't play it, so it's fine.
That's true. I got about 15 more years, so I'm good.
Dog ears?
Oh man, you got this live crowd tonight.
Well, some of us.
Guillaume, get your shot in while you can.
I stopped paying attention.
But yeah, but those games are not going anywhere, so just remember that. And
yeah,
if you don't play that game, it will not be the end of the world because there's going to be a better game in that same genre that will come along probably about the same time next year.
Right, and because here's the thing. What'll happen is you'll buy a game, and then a game that you want to play more will come out. And you'll buy that and play that instead of the game that you already bought. Well, if you know
exactly
that,
and that stacks and stacks and stacks
right.
over years.
Yep.
But so you just—it's a little bit of mental planning you have to do. It's not just about self-control; it's just about planning. Like, hey, I'm going to play this game next. I know, like, I'm not going to announce it on the show, but I know the next game I'm going to play, and it's sitting right next to my TV, waiting for me to put it in there.
You have a system. And that you've put a lot of thought into the balancing of these forces and the prioritization.
It's sort of just developed naturally, though.
Explain it, James.
Well, it's really not that complicated. I know what I'm going to play,
mm-hmm.
and I purchase it. I know what I'm going to play in the near future.
Okay.
And I don't buy games on top of that.
But you do have a queue, correct?
There is a queue. Mm-hmm. There's a handful of games. It's about four deep. I'm not counting the. When I went and did something really dumb last year and bought like 3 PS2 games on the show floor of E3. That was just stupid.
You and I sit there and we go on PSN and buy
PSN,
like 10 games.
Yeah, but I'm treating those like Steam games, essentially.
Yeah. Because
we paid 32 cents for Tokyo Jungle. I mean.
Yep.
So I've got these games that I've bought that I wanted to play. And sometimes there are things that I'm taking a pass on for the purpose of the show, like Deception 4. Like, that's not something I would have normally played myself. I would have looked at it and watched videos and gone, what the hell is wrong with you people?
Yeah.
But I knew that there was an opportunity for me to play it and it would make sense for me to buy it. And so that was a decision process I made when I bought those games.
Looked at Deception 4 and said, man, I'm going to have to play that for my Nintendo podcast.
I am.
That's just the job calls. You got to do the duty.
I like to give our audience the opportunity to understand beyond their normal sphere of of observation. So if that means they're going to play...
That explains a lot about your tenure on the podcast, James.
You're a giver, James.
If that means I'm going to play a JRPG about classmating with your seven female co-students, fine. That's what it's going to come down to. I have a job to do.
Just another day at the office.
Just another day at the... I am your hero, just so you know.
Somebody's got to do it.
It's true. Mm-hmm. But it's just a matter of I keep them, and they're right there where I see them when I'm sitting down to play games. And I just, when I finish a game and I'm ready to go on the next one, I go down there and I pick it up and play it. I know what the next one is because it's essentially, it's sorted on the list right now. And I'm just looking at it. So if I come into possession of a new game, I find where it goes in the list. But I try not to do that if I know I've got one I'm getting ready to start playing. So, when we do a retroactive, that can kind of throw things out a little bit, because I've been dumping ungodly amounts of time into Twilight Princess, because that game takes forever to do anything.
I mean, that's why I'm talking about Typing of the Dead Overkill this week.
Yeah,
it's because, you know, the games that I might normally put 3 or 4 hours into over the course of the week, those aren't getting played because of Twilight Princess right now.
That's part of the reason why I went back to a GameCube game, because I didn't want to introduce a new game to the queue, and I didn't want to pull one off the queue while the Wii U is busy doing Twilight Princess.
Well, guess why I was talking about a 2006 Wii release and a 2009 DS release. I'm just getting rid of the backlog very expediently.
So playing this retro game ends up, you know, getting us to play other retro games just because we need something that's around that feels new to us but is relatively easy to jump into.
I would say the activity I've been doing this year of just keeping a graph of what I've been playing, a chart. And I tweeted out yesterday, I think, of where I'm at. It forces you to keep, I don't want to say forces you to keep playing games, but it keeps you moving through games. Like, you get these, I mean, I'm pretty good at managing my backlog, and I think the list is up, when I put the stuff in there that I haven't put in there yet, it'll be up to like 22 for the year. And that maybe isn't 100%, but the fact that I can go in there and say, no, I'm really not going back to this game, and just put it to that, through the status specifically for that, like, it keeps you honest. Like, you can see how many games you have in flight.
Do you feel that having those games enter into the record and become part of this little experiment, this tracking sheet that you're doing this year, do you feel that that maybe kind of validates the time you put into it and gives you
a little bit
the freedom to just move on and say, well, I didn't love that game, or I didn't finish it as much as I thought I might, but at least I played it and now it's on the list and I can move on and it still counts at the end of the year.
I think the fact that when I have my selection list of reasons or of statuses, I think the fact that I've gotten on hold and a stopped makes a big difference. Because if I look at something and it says in progress and I know I haven't touched it for 2 weeks, I have to make a decision. I have to say, am I coming back to this game, or is this game done? And that's where you can kind of build up a backlog of things in flight, because you'll start a game, then something else happens, you'll go back to that. You say, oh, I'll come back to that later. But you're never going back to that game. Maybe you are, but 2 weeks in, you can look at that list and you know if you're going to go back. You're not going to surprise yourself. Maybe a year and a half down the line, you'll go back to it. But in the immediacy, you know this playthrough is over. Or, no, I'm really going to go back to this game. And it keeps me honest on that point. So games that normally I would say, no, it's still in the backlog. It's still in the backlog. I'm going to get to it. I'm calling and saying, no, I'm really not going to play that game anymore. It's really done.
Well, I mean, you've made literal, very literal, a process that all of us kind of do internally to some extent. But, you know, I don't know that – I feel like your approach to it sounds a little extreme, and I don't think it's for everybody, but maybe certain people – will find it helpful. I think it's a little too much bookkeeping for my taste.
It definitely evolved naturally, though. Like, it's an evolution of how I grew up playing games. So the graph or the chart thing is really almost for the benefit of myself, just so I understand what I did in the year. But it's also like at the end of the year when we're trying to go through games we played, it's the biggest nightmare we have as for the show, because you're just like, oh god, what did I play? What happened? What was important this year that we did? And this makes that a non-issue. I mean, there's a database, or there's a chart rule. If it's a 2015 release, it's just highlighted. So when I do game of the year, I'll just go, show me the highlighted ones. Okay, it's that one and that one and that one. I'm done. My list is finished. But it also lets me kind of evaluate where I'm at as a game player. Like, I don't think about, you know, broadly what kind of genres I'm looking at. And it's hard to take that step back, but if you put on a list the games you're playing and, you know, your thoughts in time and how many hours you put into it, you can go, oh, I probably should try playing something else because I've done a whole shitload of JRPGs this year. And I should try to shift that focus somewhere and do something different.
Well, on that introspective note, let's do something different by moving on to the next email. And James, this one is up to you.
Leo writes, Gee, if your biggest problem is that you miss the paintball mode
in GoldenEye,
can I assume that you, Guillaume, have already pre-ordered Splatoon?
Yes, you can.
Ooh.
Yeah, well, that's most of the games, Nintendo games that released in the last year that were at last E3, I've pre-ordered just because I got a good deal out of it. There was this whole Future Shop, Best Buy, like 30% off, pre-orders. And, so it paid off, I would say, you know, like usually I would go with downloads, but the credit program was ending and, you know, for $20 off for every game or $30 off, as is the case now, because games are now $70 in Canada. Yeah, it was definitely worth it.
That tells you what the markup is on retail games, though. That they can give that kind of a discount.
Yeah. It is crazy. Yeah, I've heard Greg Seward talk about those pre-order deals a lot up in Canada. But I kind of thought this would be a good entry point for us to talk about Splatoon. There was a Nintendo Direct this morning. I don't know if any of us have had a chance to watch it yet. I did not.
I watched a little bit of it. They showed off a lot of weapons. A lot of weapons. They showed off a couple of levels. I was distracted. I was at work. I was working like an idiot. And so I wasn't really watching the video.
That's the last email, Guillaume.
And so I didn't see. But the levels looked really expensive. I'm not sure how that's going to translate. And is it just 4 against 4? Or is there 8 against 8? As well in this game.
I think 8 players coming.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to say they said an 8 player mode was coming.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that might make the big stages, more interesting than I thought. But, no, like they showed off a lot of cool stuff and it looks like a pretty meaty game, except some of the features are locked away behind Amiibo, which is, well, kind of like, single player daily challenges, so maybe it's not a big loss, but I want to see, you know, reviews to see what is in the full game in the end.
That's where I'm at. For me, it's I've heard some interesting chatter about Splatoon lately. I think it was the guys on 8-4 Play who brought up the idea that Splatoon really should be like a $20 download game. And at first I was like, that seems crazy. I mean, there's clearly a lot of content in it. Nintendo's been working very hard on it. It seems like a big deal for them. And it seems like it would kind of undercut the game's legitimacy as a new franchise for Nintendo if they only did it as a, you know, a budget priced multiplayer only download game, basically. But I think that's part of the problem is that they're not really thinking about the single player stuff very much. And for me, that's really where it comes down to, because if this was a multiplayer only game, I would agree. I would say, yeah, 20, 30 bucks is probably all I could really justify spending on it. I don't feel that I'm going to play it that much online. I feel like I'll mess around with it, kind of the way I do Mario Kart. But online isn't necessarily the main draw. It's not the primary reason that I would buy a game like this, just because, you know, I don't have anyone locally who I could play it with on a regular basis. Maybe every now and then. And then online, it's not clear at all that it's going to have a big community or that the online play is going to be really all that, addictive or whatever word you want to use. You know, I don't know if it's going to be that sticky. So you just wonder looking at this, wait, how much am I really going to play Splatoon? I mean, if you're not confident in that, I can see thinking that it's maybe seems overpriced. But for me, the big question is that single player mode. And does it just feel like you're facing off against bots, or does it feel like there's real unique level design and a really clear idea about how you're going to progress through these levels and make it feel like a real campaign where you're going from A to B to C to D? I'm very curious about that. And that will basically determine whether I buy the game at all.
Yeah, but Johnny, like, we've got a big platform here. We can make an online community happen.
We could, but do I care? I mean, I don't know. I've never really played Splatoon in a real online setting. So, you know, with Mario Kart and Smash Brothers, you kind of know what you're getting into. You're like, well, as long as it works online, I know I'm going to have fun and I'll play it sometimes at least. But with Splatoon, maybe I think it's really shallow and I get tired of it after a week, you know, or maybe it's the most fun I've ever had online.
I've got good news, Johnny.
Yeah.
By the time this is over, there'll have been demos.
Well, true. Yes. We're waiting on that right now, but I am curious. I'm definitely going to put some time into that, and I think it'll be a real trial by fire.
You will put, like, what, 3 hours?
3 hours.
On three different time zones, like, you know.
I'll do what I can.
Yeah, that demo is weird. It's more of a kind of a beta test, or what's further?
It's a promotion. It really is what it is. It's an event.
Okay.
It's a test fire. Let's just be honest.
John, stop reading the marketing material. That doesn't count as podcast participation when you're reading marketing material.
All right.
But I don't know. I think it's got potential. It's got, you know, kind of the potential to be as fun to me as Left 4 Dead 2 was. So, yeah, I fingers crossed. Like, it looks, I've already pre-ordered it, so I'm kind of jumping in already without knowing everything about it. But, yeah, if, like, listeners probably on Monday nights want to play with me when it's out, bring it on.
I mean, I'm very excited about the game, but I'm not sure I want to own it. And that seems like a weird thing to say.
Yeah, I'm in kind of the same boat.
I played it probably 4 or 5 times during E3 last year. Because I just kept walking away thinking, like, wow, this game is really surprising the hell out of me. Because it just felt so, like, there was an undeniable degree of energy over in that area when it was being played. Like you could just, people were just really having fun, and it was somewhat, you know, addicting to be in that area. It felt very different from anything else on the floor in that way. So,
and yet, Smash Brothers was on the floor.
Yeah, but even then, there just felt like there was more energy over there. Because Smash Brothers, people would get super engrossed in their game.
Whereas, and also, the Smash Brothers demos were much more spread out around the booth, whereas Splatoon was focusing. All interest in Splatoon was, this is a very specific E3 kind of inside baseball thing, but
yeah.
Splatoon took up a specific corner of the booth, and so everyone over there was talking about Splatoon and thinking about Splatoon, and so it's a little different.
Everybody was playing the same game, too. Like, that was part of it. So every person you were around was playing the same game as you.
In the same match, the same level, right.
So there was a certain degree of, you know, you would watch the game as you came up on it, sort of. It was very, very E3 only kind of experience, but
I'm skeptical of that translating to the home experience, especially without voice chat, which is exactly why we've spent so much time of lambasting Nintendo, because I completely agree with you. It was one of the most exciting things at E3, and not just in Nintendo's booth, but for the whole show. But a lot of that excitement came because people would go up to it in groups and they would talk to each other, and they would kind of, especially if you're going back for the second or the third or the fourth time.
Oh, yeah.
You feel like you know the basics and you actually want to go in and try some strategy and see how that, you know, leverages the game in your favor and see if you can kind of really start to play at a higher level than the people who are randomly walking up to it for the first time. But you could do that stuff because you're able to talk to each other during the match.
Yeah, to me it was like bringing somebody to the game who had not played it before. Like, that was, like, there was something, like, you didn't get that from Smash Bros. Like, I was like, this is Smash, go play Smash. But I think it's because it's such a known quantity.
Yeah, and I mean, Smash is, it's competitive. You know, there's no really cooperation in it.
Not when we play, John.
Well, I mean, with Splatoon, I mean, not having voice chat is kind of brutal because, I mean, there's times it's a team game, and that means that you will want to cooperate in more than just stupid, you know, speech, just like, you know, speech that's mapped to a D-pad, you know, little dialogue text.
Well, I know of at least like 3 Wii U owning idiots that I talk to regularly on Skype, and like, why can't I just team up with these guys?
It's the thing is, I don't want to do that every time I play a game. I don't mind doing it for like a Smash tournament where it's like something I have to do, you know, just to kind of make that event happen. But to do that every single time I play game, screw that. I don't want
to
do
it. I have to like unplug a bunch of shit from my guest room where the computer's set up and then carry it over in there and like resync my wireless headset to it and then load up Skype and deal with fucking Skype updating every time you turn it on. And then we have to set it up and you wait for everybody. And then not only do you have to find everyone on Skype and set all that up and get that going, but then you also have to meet up and make all those arrangements and say, okay, I'll create the lobby. No, I already created the lobby. Okay, you join. It's not showing up on my screen. Oh yeah. You know, and it's like, it's just this other whole other layer of crap that makes this whole thing very complicated. And that's a big problem. I mean, Nintendo is trying to appeal to people who don't necessarily play a ton of online games. Like, they're trying to make this thing accessible, and they're trying, and, you know, the whole reason they're not doing voice chat is because they don't want to turn away people who have, you know, hear people cursing and saying awful things to each other. But you can also turn away people from the experience and from even trying to play the game online by making it too complicated or making the experience not satisfying enough because you can't really have this in-depth planning that you might want to do in such a game as Splatoon. You know, I'm not saying every online game needs voice chat, but this one sure seems like it would benefit a lot from it. And that's the reason that we keep coming back to this. And, you know, decisions like that and Nintendo's weird lobby systems and things like that in the past, their bad skill-based matchmaking in various Mario Karts where you end up getting pitted against some dude who, you know, his tournament or his online score is like 8 times higher than yours. And of course, he gets first every single race. Like, that stuff's not fun. You know, you gotta fix that shit. Your game doesn't become magical for everyone who connects online to play it against strangers or their friends just because you take out, the possibility of people cussing at them. You know, you have to be a lot more proactive than that. And I just don't know that Nintendo is really ready to make that step. I guess we'll see with Splatoon.
What I hope is that it's not like, you know, Mario Kart where it forces you to wait every time you start a match for no reason. Because I saw that they have the game, the squid drop or whatever it is. You can play that game while waiting for people to join your match.
That's some Namco Bandai stuff right there.
I was like, okay, that seems cool, but why would they put that in there? Is it just because you're going to sit there for 3 minutes or so waiting to get into a game for absolutely no reason?
Well, that's the concern. I have a lot of questions open still about Splatoon how all these little detailed things are implemented, because that stuff really adds up to the user experience. And if they screw up a bunch of that stuff, it's going to be a big problem for the game really keeping our attention.
Well, the trailers and the direct, like the footage that they show, it looks like the game is fun enough that I do want to put in the work to try and get the fun out of it. You know, like I do want to get people, like, you know, you're probably going to see me tweet like, oh, I'm about to play Splatoon. So follow me at Guillaume NWR. And
it'll have a vibrant community of Nintendo podcast hosts.
Yeah, I think, you know, from Guillaume and I sparring in the past over first person shooters, I think that this game actually...
It's a third person shooter.
Well, shooters.
Right.
I think this game might be right up his alley just because it's pretty much... You know, it kind of goes against what I like, or rather, like, what I expect, really. That's the thing with me. It's like, you know, I have a bunch of other first-person shooters that, and I can just hop on and enjoy them. And, you know, they have, like, full online, full voice chat, or whatever I want, right? But, you know, Guillaume's not as into, you know, shooters, so, you know, this may very well be perfect for him, and just the fact that he doesn't care about a lot of the stuff I care about.
I still think it could appeal to you, John. I mean, I know you're a much more, you know, discerning player, maybe, of shooters. Maybe discerning is not the right word, but and you're looking for different things. But I think Splatoon has the potential to appeal to both of you, and that's what's so exciting about it.
Yeah, and I think that I can just I don't really care that much about the lack of some of the features in Splatoon, because the way that I play online games, either I don't want a time commitment and I just want to drop in and I'm going to play against strangers most of the time. And so I don't really care if I can't talk to them or not. And, or if I want to repeat my, you know, my great Left 4 Dead 2 experiences, I want a regular thing. Like every Monday, we're playing from this hour to this hour. And, you know, we're meeting up and we're setting the game and then we go. So, and I feel like, you know, this game, Splatoon, can kind of accommodate that. Like the second way is a little bit more work, you know, like you have to set things up, you have to use Skype, etc. But still, I think I'm going to get a lot out of this game.
Yeah, I hope so. I still think it looks awesome. And the mechanics are really interesting, and I want to spend more time with them for sure. And I'm really curious about that campaign mode, the single player stuff. I'm very excited to learn more about it and to really try it for myself. So anyway, let's wrap up with one last, fairly quick email here. This is maybe a bit of a joke, but we'll leave that to the listener to decide. So the last email comes from Vincent, who writes, "I was listening to one of your older episodes, number 340, and you guys started talking about how the Wii U was really lacking in a big, mature AAA game. Fast forward to today, and even though we finally have Bayonetta 2, there still isn't much in terms of a mature, big-budget title. With Hideo Kojima leaving Konami, do you guys think it is possible that Nintendo would be willing to fund a project of his similar to what they did with Bayonetta 2? What kind of project would you guys want out of Kojima if he was to work for Nintendo? Would you want an original IP or perhaps have him work on a current established Nintendo IP like Metroid, Fire Emblem, or something older like Punch-Out? I personally believe that an original IP from the creator of Metal Gear would be a huge selling point for people, and with the backing Nintendo could give Kojima, money surely wouldn't be an issue. I also believe would help Nintendo possibly sell not only consumers but other game developers that the Wii U is capable of having mature, story-driven games Kojima likes to create."
I'm not a big Kojima fan. I'm sorry. I played through the first Metal Gear Solid, and it left me cold.
I'm not sure that what he does would appeal to a large portion of Nintendo's loyal fan base.
I mean, I don't know that necessarily appeals to a large portion of any fan base. I mean, he has a very specific audience that cares very deeply for what he does.
He would bring his own fans with him. That would be the idea, certainly.
They care very deeply about Metal Gear. I don't know if they care very deeply about Zone of the Enders. Was that really...
Zone of the Enders has an incredibly hardcore fan base.
Sure, but it's a small one. No, most of the people who played the first game played it because there was a demo for Metal Gear Solid 2.
That's my point. All of his, I mean, his games sell okay. They're not like destroy all sales numbers. Especially the last couple. I mean, he has an audience that cares about what he does.
They're gonna stick with him no matter what. But I think the question is, have they shown that they will move en masse with him to other franchises outside of Metal Gear? I mean, Kojima's made games on Nintendo platforms. He did the Boktai series on GBA, which was not a big hit.
I mean, they made three of them.
Yeah, I mean, they did okay. Also, they were GBA games. They were cheap to make back then.
Well, one was a DS game too, but yeah.
That was the fourth one. And then, you know, he did Twin Snakes with, of course, that was a Silicon Knights joint primarily, I get, but Kojima was a producer on that. He was very involved with it. You know, on one hand, I could say Nintendo probably wouldn't try that again. I feel like they might have said, well, we worked with Kojima. It went fine. The sales weren't there. It didn't seem like our fans were that interested in Metal Gear, or it didn't seem like his fans were interested in playing a GameCube version of Metal Gear.
I'll give you the counter argument there, though. We talked about it last week. The fact that the 3DS version of Metal Gear Solid 3 seemed to have sold pretty well.
It did, mostly in Japan.
Maybe they would work with him on 3DS instead, and let him make something there. The problem here for Kojima as a developer is that he's probably not going to find someone willing to give him the kind of just absurd degrees of blank checks that Konami was cutting for him.
Because I don't think Nintendo can afford, or even if they could afford, I don't think they would let him do that.
I mean, ultimately, Konami was sort of beholden to him to the point where they had to make a move. I mean, I'm not necessarily saying that move was the right move for them to make, But essentially, it had gotten to the point where they probably couldn't talk him back from spending all of their money. Like, they wouldn't be able to make a coherent argument to him of, you need to step this down a little bit. We're spending a lot of effing money here. Because it had just grown to the point where each of these games became a more and more astronomical development cost.
And their whole premise would mean that in the future they would just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger and
right.
bigger.
They had to be bigger than their predecessors. I mean, as a conceit. So the ability to start over for him and start in a new place, divorced from the Metal Gear franchise, gives him the ability to reset too, because ultimately he was caught in that same feedback loop. He had to keep one-upping himself.
Yeah, I'm sure part of it was the fact he was kind of burnt out making games that big.
That's why he always threatens that this one will be my last, and this time I guess he was right.
I mean, like, let's say he was able to go back and do something on the scale of, like, the first Zone of the Enders game. That's not a big game. It has a very coherent idea. It has a very, you know, driven point of, it wants to do this, this is what it does, this is how it plays, this is how it presents itself.
I wouldn't say it has a coherent story, no, but maybe the gameplay idea is coherent.
As a pitch, like, I know exactly how that pitch meeting went. Because, yeah, like, there are shows that it apes wholesale. And it's like, this is what we want to be. We want to make this, we make a video game version of this. Okay, go do it. Like, if he could start over from ground zero, maybe Nintendo would make that play. Because they could say, look, you're not getting Metal Gear Solid 4 budgets.
Yeah.
So, scale accordingly.
I could see it turning into a Sakurai situation where he basically runs his own studio.
Yeah.
It's semi-independent of Nintendo, but Nintendo's basically paying the bills and they're going to publish the game that they're working on. And Kojima can sort of assemble whoever he wants for the studio in order to crank it out. Or he can work with another developer and he's just sort of the name and the main creative vision, and some other studio makes whatever he wants. But it would have to be a relatively modest game.
I mean, maybe something could happen. Like, they could say, hey, while you're on hiatus, why don't you come over here and help us make one of these smartphone games that we're putting out?
If he wanted to make those, he could just go work for any other company.
Or he could have stayed at Konami.
He could, but he could just help out on the project and he wouldn't really have to do anything but rake the checks in. I mean, that's the thing. I'm sure there's going to be once the split is done, he's going to probably take some time off.
Yeah.
So
here's the target for the company that Johnny's talking about. Cause he's already done this. He did this with, Metal Gear, was it Revengeance? Like, he's already worked with, well, actually, he changed
companies. That was Platinum, but yeah.
He changed companies midstream to Platinum and ultimately has a very strong working relationship with them. So maybe the answer is one of the platform holders brings Platinum in to make a co-produced game with him as the joint, because they can crank out them games and they have no problem making deals for platform exclusive games because they've got one for all of them coming.
Yeah. And that could go to any of the platform holders, but I would put Nintendo in the mix as being, you know, one of the companies that might actually be interested in that. So I don't think it's out of the question for, I know this idea was laughed off the Bombcast last week. And was saying also, like, I just don't really see that as a good match. And I kind of agree, but at the same time, again, it's happened before. It could happen again. It's not that outlandish for Kojima to work on a Nintendo game. He's done it.
Here's the problem. I think when people talk about Kojima, they reductionistly, you know, he's Mr. Metal Gear. He's not Mr. Metal Gear. He does other stuff. He certainly, I mean, the Knights game, Lunar Knights, Boktai, those are very cartoonish games. They have a very playful spirit about them. Like, that's totally in the wheelhouse. He can make those games.
And these guys do not want to be trapped making these huge game projects forever. We've seen this with you know, so many people where they're just like, I don't want to do X anymore. I just want to go do something different.
I mean, in Nintendo themselves, Miyamoto's in that position. Like, he's talked about, like, I don't want to make another Zelda game, personally. Like, I'll oversee them. I don't want to be the guy. That's awful. In fact, the person that he made the guy has made that determination. He doesn't want to be the guy anymore.
Right. Yeah. I kind of wonder how much longer Aonuma is, like, directly involved with Zelda, because he's been doing that for 15 years and I bet he's getting burned out.
He didn't personally direct, Skyward Sword. I mean, he was the EP on that game. It is kind of like this machine that eventually you have to step away from, and the best way to step away from doing something big, I mean, as somebody who's worked on, you know, six, eight, 13-month projects, which is like a fraction of the time there, you kind of want to do something really small where you could do, you know, something completely different from where you were. And maybe that's why that would work. That pairing would work. I mean, ultimately, it's just a matter of would making a Metal Gear game make sense? No, but would making a game like Bokuto or even making a game like Zone of the Enders make sense? Absolutely, it would.
Yeah, if you want an experience that would be entirely different than working for several years on one of those Metal Gear games, it would be working with Nintendo on something.
Especially if it's like a 3DS game, or maybe a Wii.
Exactly, something very small scale, or small to mid scale.
You have to think about the broader question of working for him versus, man, those crazy stories.
Yeah.
What if he went back to his roots instead of doing something new and just did, like, visual novels?
Just made Snatcher?
Yeah, make Snatcher. I mean, there was the story earlier this month that some people created a demo of Snatcher for the Virtual Boy. Like, that's going to give Kojima some ideas, right?
That's funny. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, he could very well go smartphone. Because, I mean, he could just sit there and no pressure on him, and he could just crank out games and just experiment and do whatever.
Yeah. Or make it for 3DS. I don't know.
I mean, yeah, ultimately, any place that he wants to go will listen. That's the big deal. He has the cards here.
And he has the advantage of his name. Like, right. More so than even, you know, Miyamoto's name doesn't get slapped on the game box the way Kojima's does.
Slapped on the development team.
He has arguably the most famous name in modern Japanese game development. I mean, maybe just, you know, average person on the street. Have you ever seen the word Kojima before? Yeah, probably. Because they write it out on the marketing, on the game art, you know, on the title screen. You see it everywhere when you watch the opening credits to one of his games. His name's going to come up 10 times.
And that's part of the reason the relationship with Konami had gotten so toxic. Because they couldn't back him down because ultimately they owed him.
But there's kind of a creative battle there that you could sense for a long time, I thought. The tension between that guy and his artistic sensibilities and his weird ego or whatever. It seemed there was something political going on with the company itself and some kind of constant struggle. So I can't say I'm at all surprised that this happened. To me, it felt inevitable for a long time. But... you know, he'll be around. That guy, I don't think the movie industry is going to take him. So I think he's stuck making video games, and I think he'll continue to make video games. Speaking of which, we're actually another Konami expat. By the time you hear this episode, or very soon after, we're supposed to be finding out Koji Igarashi's next game.
Have you been following that website?
Well, let's take a poll. I mean, are you Sword or Whip? I'm Whip.
Of course you are, John.
I'll say Sword.
I'm Whip. Oh, fuck, Johnny. I thought I knew you, man. Ugh. James, what are you?
Do you think I want to be associated with you and bullwhips? Hell no.
Hey, are you Sword or are you Sword
I'm
or Whip?
Sword.
Okay, Gi?
I chose Whip, but I...
Yes!
Yeah, the thing is, I think there's more gameplay ideas you could do with the Whip, although they've pretty much all been done, like in Indiana Jones games or in Castlevania games, so I don't know. And if he's asking now, that means that the whole Whip thing is not really going to enter into the level design.
No, he's not necessarily asking, like, this is what the game's going to be about. I think it's more a matter of the game is probably going to feature both, and this
yeah.
is...
Canadians like Whips. Confirmed.
I do like that website is just so ridiculous. Occasionally it'll just say things like check back Monday for my game or maybe not. But like just random text. And the fact that he's put his own face over what looks like a Dracula model from a Super Nintendo game.
Yep.
Yeah, and you can also put the code in and it says why do you think that would work?
Right, here? The Konami code, yeah.
Cleverly done. I have a feeling that we should all get our Kickstarter accounts ready to go. I'm excited to see what that is. I really like that guy, and if he's going to make some kind of like Castlevania, but not really, you know, like basically Castlevania, I'm really into that because Konami's probably done making Castlevania games for a long time, and I'm more than happy to see Mr. Igarashi go out on his own and do that. So I'm really looking forward to it. And whatever it is, it'll, if it's on Kickstarter especially, it'll probably come to a Nintendo platform. And that's good for everybody listening to this show.
Like we talked a little bit about this, I think we did, last week when, with, you know, the Rare Expats Kickstarter.
Oh yeah, Yooka-Laylee.
Yeah, which just blew through all its funding goals.
Yeah, I was surprised at the energy behind that campaign.
They've spent the last 3 months, you know, priming the ground. Sort of what IGA's doing right now. Yeah, I mean, they're doing these kinds of things that don't really cost money, but getting people involved. That this might be, you know, it's a little disconcerting as a fan who wants to see these games get made, you know, on the grand scale. But, you know, these are people who are very passionate about what they do in an industry that's not necessarily interested in making what they want to make. So, you know, maybe Kojima does go find his mix of Halo investors and crowdfunding to make whatever he wants himself. I mean, ultimately, there's flexibility there to make what you want to make. Maybe not, you know, the highest production values. Maybe not the, you know, maybe he doesn't get to use Fox Engine wherever he goes next time. But, you know, the opportunity to build what he wants to build in his vision is potentially there for him. Just so long as you understand what a budget is. And there's not evidence that he does, but maybe he'll find that person who could teach him, hey, you don't need to spend money on that.
Maybe this will be the turning point for
him. We don't need to sign a deal with the actor from The Walking Dead when you could never see him in the game. We can sign that deal after the playable trailer becomes a real game.
Remember, Kojima, editors save you money.
Oh.
Two birds with one stone there. All right. Well, we're going to have to wrap up this episode. Thanks everyone for listening. Thank you to everyone who sent their emails in. Of course, we have a backlog of those too, but just like our video games, we will clear through them eventually. We will strive to do that strategically. So as always, you can send in your emails to suggest any topic or ask any question of us to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com or go to the article on our website and use the link there. We're probably going to have guests the next couple of weeks because James is going to be out of town. So stay tuned for a little bit of a change up over the next couple episodes. And we did, we got an email for someone asking for our E3 predictions. And I know some other podcasts have already started to do that, rather prematurely, it feels like to me. Traditionally, we do it very close to the show, and we are hoping to do that, probably late May or even very early June. I have to look at the calendar to see how the production schedule is going to shake out. We might even end up doing it the same episode as our retroactive, which will be in 3 weeks, I guess. The third show after this one, as soon as James gets back, we will do the Twilight Princess retroactive. So, if you haven't started playing yet, I'd say it's not too late, but you're going to have to really cram it in there. Cause again, it's a big meaty game, but a really, really fun and interesting one. And I think we're going to have a great discussion about it once James is back on the show. So we're all going to be cramming for that while he's gone. And I hope you will too. That's it. Thanks again to Karen for joining us earlier. And thanks to all of you for listening. We'll see you next week right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye.
Bye.
Club Super Sex.
Damn it.
Guillaume is going to read the first email this week.
Sure. I don't really know basketball. Is it Kobe or Kobe?
Kobe.
I think it's Kobe.
Kobe. Okay.
Kobe.
Kobe. Kobe's kill. Right?
Yes.